This is Rebecca from New Haven, Connecticut. You are listening to WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Welcome to Book Talk, where we talk about books. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and today we'll be discussing the novel The Burning Girl, first with the author, Claire Massoud, and then with my guests, Christopher Jansma and Emily Moore. And stay tuned at the end of the show for a middle grade recommendation from one of our friendly New Haven librarians. It's a different story, depending on where you start, Julia, our narrator, tells us. Who's good? Who's bad? What it all means. Each of us shapes our stories so they make sense of who we think we are. I can begin when Cassie and I were best friends, or I can begin when we weren't anymore, or I can begin at the dark end and tell it all backward. Depending on where you start, this is a story of a friendship that unravels, or the story of what it is to move from girlhood into womanhood, or the story of what it means to try to save someone. And always, no matter where you start, it's the story of what it is to tell a story, the story of the power and the limits of narrative, the story of how stories can excuse us, or condemn us, or redeem us. I had the opportunity last week to speak with author Claire Massoud, and I'd like to share that interview with you now. Claire Massoud was born in Connecticut and grew up in the U.S., Australia, and Canada. She graduated from New Haven's own Yale University and now lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Burning Girl is her sixth novel. Claire, thanks so much for joining me today on Book Talk on WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Sid, thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful to be with you.
So Claire, on the second page of this book, our narrator, Julia, talks about the difficulty of knowing where to begin. And she says, it's a different story depending on where you start. Who's good? Who's bad? What it all means. Each of us shapes our story so they make sense of who we think we are. I can begin when Cassie and I were best friends, or I can begin when we weren't anymore, or I can begin at the dark end and tell it all backward. And that felt to me like you as a writer almost speaking through Julia to us. And so I wanted to start by asking, how did you, as the writer of this story, decide which of these beginnings to pursue? If you tried writing it multiple ways and how you ended up where you ended up?
Now, that's an interesting question. It's a sort of tough one to answer in a way, because I think as a writer, I'm someone, so much of what I do is instinctive, and I do try things different ways. And then it really is about what feels right to me. The passage itself is, yes, indeed, in some way, me speaking through Julia. And for me, that's part of what the whole book is about, mm-hmm. is about the ways in which we, as individuals, as groups, as a town or village, as a culture, tell stories and tell stories to make sense of each other, of ourselves, of our lives. And we spin those stories in the way that suits us most. I mean, few of us tell stories in which we come off badly. Or so when Julia says, I could start all these places, but then she starts with a story that makes her come about when the girls met when they were small, mm-hmm. and about how she, you know, she was such a good pal to Cassie, and that's how they became friends. So she starts off with a story that makes her look good, you know, and even though as their friendship progresses, it eventually unravels. Her version of the unraveling is one in which she doesn't really take a lot of blame. She tells it about losing her friend Cassie, but if you look closely, there are places where you realize, you know, she wasn't being such a good friend to Cassie either at certain points.
And there are moments, I feel like, where she is questioning herself and her own culpability in it. There's a lot of moments when she asks herself, you know, if she was willfully not seeing things that she should have seen, or not taking action when she could have taken action.
Right. And that's in retrospect, you know, that's sort of right. Years later. When she's telling the story, she's just about to go into her last year of high school. So she's, you know, she's sort of 17, and she's looking back at time, you know, from when the girls were 12 onwards, and looking over those years, and she has more self-knowledge in retrospect than she did at the time.
Well, I wanted to ask about that choice too, if, in terms of her age at the time of telling it, because she is still only 17, so she has a little bit of perspective, but not as much say as she might have if she was 35. And really, she's still very much in that process of coming of age. And I wondered if it was important to you that she still be relatively close to that time and why you made that choice.
Yes, it was important to me. One of the things that, you know, when anybody writes a story, so many different pieces are coming together. I think of it as a sort of magpie-like thing where you take one thought that's been obsessing you and a character from somewhere else that you've been thinking about and the storyline, you know, that you've made up out of some, you know, and you put them all together and you hope that they can fit. But one of the elements that is perhaps not so much on the surface, but was very much part of this book for me. My husband and I have two wonderful kids who are teenagers now, and partly it was watching our kids go through the time that this book is about, but also before they were teenagers, I spent a lot of time reading with them children's books that I loved from my own childhood, and also books I discovered again. And there is something about the way that children's stories or myths, Greek myths or fables, there's a way that we as readers approach them that is different from the way we approach adult fiction. And it's with a sort of simplicity and authority and almost an acceptance of strangeness that is the way that I think children actually experience the world, because whatever they experience, they assume is not, they don't question whether it's normal. It's normal because it's happening to them. Mm-hmm. So much of what we live through in our story lives, if you will, our literary lives as kids, we just accept it and sort of take it on board. And I wanted Julia to retain, even though she's crossed the Rubicon. She's sort of passed over into young adulthood, but I wanted her still to be. There's actually a line from Wordsworth that I refer to in the book, not explicitly quoting Wordsworth, but trailing clouds of glory. That's a line from a Wordsworth poem about childhood, and I wanted her still to have a sort of acceptance of certain things or an understanding of certain things that wasn't logical or analytical. It was more myth-like or fable-like. And so that was something that at 35 would not have been possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was interesting because that when you talk about myth and fable, and I felt very much like fairy tales are hinted at in this novel. There's, you know, the sort of dark forest and the evil stepfather. And yet I think of fairy tale as very kind of black and white, right? There's the good person and the bad person and the quest and the resolution. And what's so interesting about the juxtaposition here to me is that this is a story that then challenges that narrative, that challenges the idea of, you know, that a story can unfold that neatly and that, in fact, you know, the narrative line, you can be trusted in that way. So I wonder if you can talk a little about that tension.
Yes, well, you're articulating something that I was trying very much to sort of what tackle, I guess is the verb. A friend of mine, but once he was just a writer I admired greatly, the Australian writer Peter Carey. I interviewed him once, and he said, if it doesn't seem impossible, it's not worth trying. And I've more than any of my books, although each of them has seemed impossible, this one seemed impossible to me because I was trying to do almost contradictory things. Mm-hmm. And one of them was to write a story that appeared simple. And it's very hard, actually, to do something simple, or it is hard for me. I guess I'm somebody sort of who makes things complicated. It's just my nature. So for me to try to make it simple was an effort. I wanted it to be something that on one level can be read just as a simple story about two friends and their friendship unraveling. But I also wanted it to be about stories and how we tell stories, as I was saying earlier, how we are inclined to fit our lives or our experiences into the experiences and stories that we have already internalized, that we've already taken in, whether they're the fairy tales that we read with our parents when we were kids, or the stories that we've seen on TV, or you know, that our friends have told us. There are all these stories that we're surrounded by all the time, and we take them in, and they stay in us, and they shape the way that we see things. And we see stories themselves as a way of finding resolution or finding clarity or finding order. And yet sometimes we have to leave out a lot of what's really there in order to make our stories fit the narrative shape, if that makes sense. I was reading an article about the way our eyes and our brains work. This is when I was working on the book, and I was so interested that, in fact, our brain only processes about 30% of what our eye actually sees, and the rest of our sort of understanding of what's in front of our eyes is filled in by our brains from previous experience. So that's why, for example, kids will see monsters in their bedrooms, is because they see the pile of clothing and they can't tell what it is, and their brain doesn't have, 30 years of piles of clothing to fill in and just say, I know, I recognize that shape as a pile of clothing. A child is really can't make sense of what it is, and so says, I think it's a monster. It might be something I don't know. But when you get older and you've seen a lot of piles of clothes,
right.
Your brain just fills in for you.
Well, this theme of, of how we use stories and how we tell stories and what we leave out and where the truth lies is actually like my favorite thing in the world. And I constantly mention on this show, like every episode, the book, The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, because I feel like that's the book that I read when I was 17 that first introduced me to this idea that, like, to tell a true story, you need to keep telling it and leave certain things out and put other things in until you are able to get across what you're trying to say. And so I wonder if you have books that are kind of your touchstones for grappling with this idea, and if it's something that you've always been interested in, or if it's something that only recently you felt compelled to address in your writing.
It's something that I've been interested in, I think, for a long time. Certainly, if I look back at my earlier books, The Woman Upstairs is very much about that. That was my last novel, and it's in some ways a sort of, in my head, it's very different from this book, but they're sort of related in a way, because that's about the friendship between two middle-aged women. And then there's even in The Emperor's Children, which is 10 years ago, it was something that was interesting to me. There are lots of different, it's in the third person, but there are lots of different points of view, and the different experiences that the different characters have of some of the same things,
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's always been of interest to me. And I think, I don't know if you go around your house saying, as we do around ours, it's a Rashomon thing.
Right.
But, there is, of course, there's the famous Japanese film, but in which the characters tell the story, each tells the same experience in a different, it becomes a different story. But that's true. That's true of stories going back. I mean, that's true of the Gospels, right? We can compare the different versions of some of the same parables or gospel stories told by different disciples. So I think it is one of those things that is just so deeply ingrained in us, and yet that we in our daily lives almost overlook. Because if you start to get too mired in the question, you lose you lose your ability to, like, what's true? Who's said it right? You know, who's, what side do I take? And we're always sort of correcting for that, I think, without even thinking, but we don't dwell too much on it in our lives, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it seems to me when you're writing a book that grapples with these questions, you by definition have to leave a lot of things unanswered. So here, for example, we never know what really happens between Cassie and her stepfather. There are hints that there might be some kind of abuse, but maybe not. And we never find out whether Cassie's mom has been lying to her about her father being dead, or whether the man that Cassie tracks down in Maine is really her father. And, you know, as you say, like, as people, that's our reality. Like, there's so many things that are unknowable. But as readers, I think we desire resolution. I mean, you sort of said this before. We, like, look to narrative to find clarity and resolution. So did you struggle with that in the writing, with writing something that both felt true in its unknowability, but also felt like it would give your reader what they needed?
Of course. You know, when I said it seemed impossible, I was like, okay, so I am going to provide what is in some ways a familiar narrative, and I'm going to deny readerly satisfaction. Well, okay, so it's on the one hand familiar, and on the other, like, I already know this story, and you're not going to give me the satisfaction. Thank you. You know, that does, it seemed a big risk, but I also, I was talking to someone at a party a year or two ago, and he was somebody who works in business and he reads fiction. And a lot of people in the middle of their lives don't read fiction. So I was, and a lot of men particularly, mm-hmm. you know, read yes. fiction. And so I was really interested. And I said, what is it that draws you back to fiction? And he said, it was basically, he said to me, I like to find order. He said, you know, when I meet people, they seem contradictory and somewhat unknowable, but when I read about a character in a novel, they're pinned down and they're clear to me, you know, their outline is really clear to me. And I was so struck by that because, of course, I think many of us read that way, and yet that's dishonest. Right.
Right. Right.
It seemed important to me. I think a lot of the writers that I love and admire the most, they write against that. They write into the openness, if you will. They write into the openness of human nature, the mystery of human relations and human behavior and who we are, you know. And I think as I get older, I think when I was younger, I believed that getting older involved knowing more and clarity and sort of pinning things down and sorting things out. And I'm 50 now, and I've come to a point where I think, no, life is just more mysterious than I ever believed. It's just mysterious. And so I felt like if that's what I believe, I have to write that.
So one thing, you know, one way to handle that, I suppose, is kind of what you did in The Emperor's Children, which is when you write it from a variety of perspectives, you acknowledge the limitations of any one person's knowledge, but you give the reader a fuller view. And I wonder if you thought at all about letting us see things from inside Cassie's head or inside Bev, her mother's head, and if you wrote any of that, or if you were always and only just with Julia.
Oh, no, I was always and only just with Julia. I mean, I think there are lots of reasons for that. But you know, one of the catalysts for this novel was watching our children, in particular, our daughter and our niece, who are now, our daughter's 16 and our niece is 19, go through this sort of middle school, early high school time, and being struck by and reminded of, you know, my own experiences years and years ago and how central bafflement is to that experience. Because when you're a kid, when you're young, you don't have the boundaries in a way of adulthood. And you think, oh, I don't know, you know, I don't really know what's going on, but I will know when I grow up. And part of what adolescence is coming up against this experience of not understanding and having to face the fact that you will never understand and you will never know. And, you know, when our daughter's best friend from since kindergarten dropped her like a a hot potato without warning for and with no explanation on the first day of, I can't remember if it was, I think it was sixth grade. We to this day don't know why. We'll never know why. You know, and even if something were invented retroactively by the girl, it would be untrue.
Right.
So I feel as though growing up is actually, I mean, I could be sort of harsh and say our desire to make order in stories is in some way childish. And actually part of growing up is realizing some things you just never know. You never know the answers. And even 20 years or 40 years or 60 years later, you will return to those stories and say, you know, I never really understood. I never really knew. I still wonder. You know, I just had a conversation with my sister yesterday about a friend of hers from high school. And she was talking about having had a conversation about that friend with another friend from high school and saying, you know, we wondered if this or this had been going on at that time. You know, if she behaved this way because of these things, but we didn't know, we still don't know. You know, a whole life goes by and you're still wondering.
Well, it's funny because I think that in this age of social media, sometimes we have this temptation. It's so easy to find people, right? And reach back out to them 20 years later. And I have certainly people like that in my life, you know, the people who've dropped you and you don't know what you did wrong or how you could have offended. And there's almost this temptation to go and ask them. But I feel like for myself, you realize that, as you said, like, you're not going to get an answer because they're going to remember it differently. And whatever answer they have now is not the answer they would have had then. And there is no resolution of the kind we desire.
Right. I think another sort of catalyst for me for this book was when I was a kid, we lived in Australia and we left when I was 9, and I kept in touch with friends from school by writing letters. And a few years later, I got in fragments through these letters the story of something that happened to one of our classmates. You know, we were at a small school. It was a small class. I knew everybody. We were all good friends. We all hung out. But I never heard it directly. And it's a story that's haunted me all my life. And then when I went to find out what the official record was of what had happened to this girl, it was completely different from what I remembered of what my friends had told me. I don't still have the letters. And I found myself thinking, first, my first thought was, oh, I've misremembered everything. And then my second thought was, no, actually, there's an official record. And then there's something that really happened. And then there's a third thing, which is what the kids knew about what happened, which wouldn't be the same as what some grown-ups, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And there's some truth to all of that.
Right. That all the stories are different stories and who knows, you know, now each of us can hold on to the version that we have. And that's the closest we're going to get.
So we don't have too much time left, but I just did want to go back to something you said right at the beginning about how you think of yourself as an instinctive writer. And I find it interesting because I interview a lot of authors for this show, and I'm very intrigued. People are very different in their approaches to writing a novel. Some people just kind of sit down and open their notebook and write and see where it takes them, and it kind of unfolds. And others are much more, I don't want to say disciplined, that's not the word, but
Organized
about it, or they have an outline and they know what the end is going to be before they begin, and they know who the characters are and their relations to each other, and they've worked all that out before they write the first line. So I wonder where you fall on that spectrum, and if you, and just talk maybe a little bit about what your process looks like.
You know, it's funny even as you were describing the first kind of writer, I'm like, and the second. they're both me. I mean, I think for me, I always do. Have a lot of work goes on in my head before I write anything. For example, I mean, you know, the Emperor's Children, I had thought about it for certainly years, several years before I wrote anything. And then I'd started writing something, and then 9/11 happened, and I had abandoned what I was writing, and I began all over again. So that was one experience, because then it was changed, you know, the sort of, the I was writing a novel about people in New York, and then the world changed. And then I was writing about a novel about the same people, but they were in a, you know, their experiences were altered, or the shape of their narrative was altered by history. In this case, you know, the story, the sort of partial inspiration, and it's not the story of Cassie in the novel is not the story from my childhood, but this being haunted by this sort of fragmentary story from my youth made me want to try to write something related to that. It must be 20 years, you know, that was when I sat down and tried to write The Emperor's Children. The alternative was to try to write something related to that. You know, that was the other thing in my head. So I sort of, you know, I was coming back to something familiar. I need some sort of outline. I do to write, even if it's 10 things on a piece of paper. And I feel that but on the other hand, in the way I felt in college, like if you've done all the research and you've taken the notes, do you have to write the paper? The professor doesn't want to read it. You don't want to write it. Couldn't you just turn in the notes and that would be enough? There has to be discovery in the writing. So it has to be an adventure, and you have to be learning something and having these sort of thrilling adventures and discoveries as you write, or else you wouldn't keep doing it.
And can you tell me what one moment of discovery was in this novel?
Yes. So one moment of discovery in this novel for me was that Cassie, in spite of everything, so loved her mother that she did not want her mother to break up with her boyfriend. That was a moment of discovery for me. When Peter says to her, you know, just tell your mom she's got to get rid of him. Like, it's not, you can't live with this. And Cassie's response is not, yeah, you're right, I should do that. Cassie's response is, my mom has given me everything and she sacrificed everything for me. And if this is what makes her happy, how could I do that? I can't.
Well, let me end with this. So we are left with all these questions that we don't know about Cassie, and we don't know what happens to her after the end of the novel. There's much we don't know about what's happened to her during the course of the novel. As the writer, do you know what's happened?
No, but I guess I come back to this to say the Greek myth thing and or the Iliad or the Odyssey, and I feel like you don't know exactly what happens to Odysseus, you know, when he's with Calypso, but you know enough. I suppose for me, and this may, I don't know what the experience is of readers, but these people are people to me. They're very real. They're very human. And that's what interests me, is our humanity and our all the particularities of our individual selves. And when somebody passes through your life and then passes out of it, you can guess, you know, maybe 10 things that, the 10 directions they might go, maybe you can guess 3 that seem likely. But the wonderful thing about life is that sometimes people totally surprise you, and you thought that things wouldn't work out for them because of all sorts of, you know, a concatenation of factors that seem to doom them to something not good. And next thing you know, there they are on America's Got Talent. You know, I mean, that's life is amazing that way. And so that's, you know, Cassie, very early on when her cat disappears, says, why not imagine something good for her? Why imagine something bad?
Yeah, I loved that line. Well, Claire, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sid. It's been such a treat. Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. Take a moment to introduce my guests, Christopher Jansma and Emily Moore. Chris first appeared on this show as an author, discussing his novel, Why We Came to the City. Emily Moore is the author of the poetry collection Shuffle and is an English teacher at my alma mater, Stuyvesant High School. Emily and Chris both appeared on Book Talk most recently, discussing Lisa Coe's novel, The Leavers. Emily and Chris, great to have you both back.
Great to be here.
So I wanted to start by reading the epigraph to this novel, which is from Elizabeth Bishop's poem, Casa Bianca. Loves the boy stood on the burning deck, trying to recite, the boy stood on the burning deck. Loves the sun stood stammering elocution while the poor ship in flames went down. And loves the burning boy. And so clearly the title of this novel, The Burning Girl, references this. So I thought maybe I'd start by asking you guys, who do you think the burning girl is here? Do you think it's Cassie or do you think it's Julia?
I definitely thought that Cassie, to me, seemed sort of like the burning girl in this. One of the things I loved about it so much was that Julius has a very sort of strong presence and voice in the novel, but Cassie is sort of the focus of it from, you know, almost like the very first couple of pages. Yeah, it seemed to me like a novel about someone watching someone they love go through something, you know, watching them burning, basically.
Yes, and you have all of these references to Cassie's hair being sort of eerie white blonde color. I wondered if that was Bernie in a way, and that amazing yeah. title metaphor that comes up later about how sort of girlhood and young womanhood is about putting on this cloak, this burning cloak that has a sort of a mystery and a pain to it. I also thought of Juliet as the observer and storyteller, and Cassie as the most compelling, or the one that's whose burning is compelling.
So I thought that too when I first read it, I think. And then I read a review in the New York Times, which was a review I for the most part did not agree with, but in the very beginning, he references this epigraph as well, and talks about themes of powerlessness and themes of inability to find the words. So you have the boy standing on the deck, stammering on, you know, the elocution, trying to recite it and being unable to tell, to recite the poem in some ways, to like tell the story. And that made me think about it in a different way, because I feel like so much of what's going on here, as I talked about with Claire in the interview, is this idea of trying to tell the story and being unable to find the words to tell it right, you know, of trying to find the narrative that is somehow true and realizing that there really isn't one. And it also is so much about this sense of powerlessness. And I think both Cassie and Julia in some ways epitomize that. You know, Julia is, you know, as you say, she's the bystander, she's the observer, but she doesn't have the power to rescue Cassie from everything that she is going through. And Cassie herself, you know, also lacks the power to extricate herself from the situation in which she finds herself. But I think maybe it's not stretching it too far to say in a way they both are. Both are the burning girl.
Oh, I love that idea. And I hadn't thought of it that way at all until you said it. But I was thinking about Bonnybrook, which is the institution, or the former mental asylum for women, I believe, where the two young girls play. And I was also thinking a little bit about the dog shelter, the animal shelter where they volunteer. And one of the things that I thought about, those are two of the main set pieces in the novel. And I was thinking, what do they have in common? And I thought, well, they're these sort of houses for these spirits that are neglected, or these women or animals that kind of don't have enough support. And I do, under that category, as a young woman who kind of doesn't have enough going for her, there's even a class element to this novel, that Cassie just doesn't have the advantages that Juliet has. But it's so interesting thinking of it now, that Juliet doesn't really have the words to even describe what Cassie's journey into young womanhood and all the possible dangers associated with it are.
Emily, I want to pick up on what you said about the dog shelter, the animal shelter, and the asylum. I thought that's so interesting. I hadn't connected the two at all, but I think they really are connected. You know, I was thinking about the asylum and about how it functions, you know, both as kind of a place of salvation, a place where, you know, both for the women who were sent there originally, women who were damaged or suffering, and they went there to supposedly to heal, but it could also in some ways be a prison for them. You know, if they didn't fit into society, that's where they were sent, and they couldn't get out. In some ways, it functions similarly for Cassie and Julia, who kind of go there as a place to escape, but, you know, it is also the place that Cassie goes to try to commit suicide. But then, you know, the animal shelter is also this place that, you know, is supposedly a place to rescue creatures who are damaged and suffering. But of course, what happens there is that this dog, Leo, this pit bull, who attacks Cassie, but only because she's doing what she's not supposed to be doing. She's in his cage and she has this treat, and he reaches for it to grab it and tears into her arm. And he ultimately is put down, right? Like, he is the victim. And so this place that's supposed to be shelter for him is ultimately the thing that murders him, right? Yeah. And I kind of like how both of these places operate in this paradoxical way, that they can be both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, I love that. And I remember when they first get there, Julia even has like a little sort of a recognition of that, you know, sort of if you're a woman that doesn't fit into society in quite the right way, that this is where you might end up, you know, being placed. I imagine the building carried the sadness of the women who'd been trapped there, the anorexic teenagers and the young mothers who heard voices, and the old women shattered past repair by their tragedies. And I just thought that was really kind of fascinating, because they're sort of looking into, you know, their futures and wondering, you know, are they going to be women who are going to be able to sort of fit into society in some way? Are they going to be stuck in a place like this? And of course, Cassie, it winds up, you know, sort of sticking herself there and in a literal way. But, you know, Julia has the resources to kind of find her place, and Cassie doesn't, I guess.
That's such a fantastic quote to lift up, and actually circling back in a different way. And maybe this speaks to the complexity of this that Masoud weaves through this book. I was looking back at the dog attack, which kind of sets the whole thing in motion. And I noticed on the second reading that Cassie is in the cage. She snuck in a little rawhide chew, which is against the rules, but sort of out of tenderness of her heart, but also misguided. And yeah. She is in Sheba's cage. And then Leo, who's this sort of big scrapper of a dog, and the door to Sheba's cage is closed, but not. Leo kind of barges in and goes for the chew and bites her arm. And then Anders Schut gets introduced because he mends Cassie's arm. Also, in a way, is this sort of complicated male who later enters into a relationship with her mother, you know, and I thought, yeah. Well, is that through the sort of unsecured door, or there's this sort of shadow of something eerie, whether it's, but that there's just sort of an interesting way that the culpability of the dog attack has some not quite transferable resonance to some of the events that occur later.
There's that scene where we first meet Schut, I guess, is so creepy. I thought, yes. She did such an amazing job of sort of setting him up as this. I started to see him, I think, the way Julia and Cassie do later, as like a Humbert sort of, you know, in Lolita, where he's, you know, he's there with the mom, but possibly because he's more interested in Cassie. And that really just hooked me. But that scene, yeah, where he treats her hand and then he gives her that little joke, which comes back a few times. Your hand will be fine if you're a good patient, not an impatient patient. And it's like not a funny joke. And then they laugh at it later. But she, even Julia, observes that at the time, that like, it's strange for a doctor to be sort of like telling her, like, the ball's in your court here, like, you know, your destiny is, you know, sort of all up to you. Are you going to make good decisions or are you not? And then so much of what happens later is really kind of outside of Cassie's hands, you know, and in particularly Schut showing up and sort of, you know, changing her whole family dynamic in a lot of ways. So
I kept coming back to the fact that, and she spoke about this quite eloquently in the author interview, that Claire Masoud never gives us the narrative satisfaction of knowing exactly what is happening behind the closed doors of Cassie and Bev's home, and yeah. How she just thwarts you at every turn. And part of the momentum of the book is Julia really trying to figure out or decide how much of the story she knows and doesn't know and needs to know. And we're right there with her doing that. And I do think that Cassie's young womanhood, or sort of girlhood on the edge of young womanhood, is part of it. And there is definitely an attention to the sort of potential paternalistic shadow that Anders Schut casts on her home and all the sort of possible dangers that she might face as a result of that. And yet at the same time, you never you never learn it. And I think that's part of what the book is about, as you heard in the interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, the things that are scariest are the things that we don't know, right? Like, mm-hmm. when you know the contours of the threat, you can start to figure out how you can counter them. But when you don't even know what you're up against, that is what is the scariest thing, right? It's the shadows. It's the shadows, and you don't know what is casting them. And I think, you know, in this case, Julia doesn't really understand or know what are the monsters that are plaguing Cassie. And so we are likewise in that position, and it is part of what makes it feel creepier and more dangerous, and like she's in even more danger than she might be if we just knew, for example, that Andrew Shute was molesting her.
Right. There was somewhere they were talking about, like, whether or not they'd feel safe staying alone at home, and that it's somehow different when they're doing that versus when they're babysitting someone else's child, even though the kid they're babysitting wouldn't be able to do anything. And I thought that was just so interesting, because then, you know, it's like when they're being the babysitter, they're almost kind of in a pretend adult role, and they have the power in that, you know, sort of scenario. And so they're not afraid to be alone. But when it's just them in their house by themselves, they don't feel any kind of control or power. They, you know, anything could be happening.
It kind of gets to what she's talking about at the end, when as a 17-year-old, she's about to apply to colleges, and she's telling her parents that she wants to pursue acting. And she talks about how she kind of sees all of life as acting, but at least, yeah, you know, kind of being on the stage, at least it kind of acknowledges the artifice of it. But what you're saying about the babysitting really makes me think of that, because it's like, well, if you're in the babysitter role, if that's the role you're playing,
yeah,
you're kind of safe because you are the adult and you're taking care of the other person. But when you're alone in the house, you're exactly in the scenario of like the CSI thing, where you're going to be the victim, and that's the role you play. And it kind of gets to the, you know, what she keeps saying, which is, I know how the story plays out. Like, I'm very good at predicting how the plot of a TV show should go, because, and it gets to what Claire Massoud was saying in the interview, like, we all live with these stories in our heads. All the books that we've read, the plays that we've seen, the movies and TV shows that we've seen, and they inform our sense of how the story is supposed to go. And so we almost unconsciously like enact that depending on which role we see ourselves as playing.
Right. That's such fertile territory. I hadn't that babysitting comment. I remembered it really quickly in my brilliant little way to open up this big door. And it makes me think too about their play in the mental institution when they're 12 and 13. And there's that lovely line about how Juliet feels like discovering it allowed them to extend their childhoods just a little bit longer. They could kind of get away with playing these fantasy games, even as, you know, junior high-ish, middle schoolish girls. And I think of those two girls kind of unafraid acting out all these spooky fantasies in the old mental institution. And it just, it gets at that age too, that sort of edge of, right, when you can babysit and be the adult, and then you're also the child in your own home, and there are these forces going on around you that don't have control over.
There's that line when they first go to the asylum, and Cassie says, can't you see this could be ours, our own world, a real world that we found and we made and we kept? And I was so struck by that, a real world, you know? It's like, it's Cassie, not Cassie, Julia says at the end, you know, her tendency to kind of turn fiction into fact, like that almost by force of will, you could create something that is real. And it's something that's their own and that's safe and that no one can come in or destroy. And I almost feel like Cassie's choice at the end to go there to try to kill herself is her way of rejecting that, of saying, you know what, it failed. Like, it, we were not able to do that. Like, we could not keep the world out, even out of this place that seemed safe. And, you know, again, so interesting to me that it's this asylum. An asylum, you know, having so many, you know, think about the multiple definitions of that word.
I love that. I thought that whole part was, I think I enjoyed watching them there the most. And it just reminded me of so many moments from my own childhood and, you know, things that I used to do like that with my friends around that same age. And one of the biggest sort of most fun things to do where I grew up used to be to go to these kind of rundown places. There were like houses in the woods that had been all grown over and you could kind of go and explore and just sort of do whatever. And it was like being in another world and having a chance to just sort of, you know, pretend that you're not in the real world, just as they sort of say. I thought that was fantastic.
I really wanted to talk about the dream that Julia has at the end when Cassie is missing and they haven't been able to find her. And she has this dream where Cassie puts on a black feathered cloak, a bird cloak. And then within seconds, it burned into her skin, grafted itself, became exquisitely, agonizingly irremovable. Hers was poisoned, a poisoned cloak. And she kind of returns to that metaphor again a little bit later, after Cassie's been found, after they have, you know, rescued her from her suicide attempt, after Cassie has gone away with her mom and they don't know where she's gone. And she says, "Now I know for what it's worth what it means to be a girl growing up. Maybe you can choose not to put on the cloak, but then you'll never be free. You can never soar. Or you can take on the mantle that is given you. But what the consequences may be, what the mantle might do, what wearing it may entail, you can't know beforehand." And I wasn't sure what to make of that, this idea of this cloak that is both poisoned but necessary for you to be able to fly, to grow up, to enter adulthood. I mean, I wonder if you guys have thoughts on that.
I kind of connected that back to that sort of wonderful moment on page one, I think it's 111. "Sometimes I felt that growing up and being a girl was about learning to be afraid." And then she starts talking about sort of, you know, the sort of realization that she has of how vulnerable she is in society. And I thought that might have something to do with sort of, you know, accepting that cloak is maybe somehow sort of accepting, you know, the power dynamic that girls have in society. And Cassie can't sort of accept her new role in this family as like subservient daughter, you know, to Anders. And Julia, you know, by luck of the draw, has a much more, you know, sort of supportive family who are kind of able to allow her a little slack and, you know, that in, you know, encourage her growth and things like that. And I wondered if that had something to do with sort of the difference, you know, putting on the cloak, and for some it's a disaster, and for others it's a magical sort of thing that allows them to fly.
Oh, that's an interesting reading. And you know, to answer your question with a question, I also thought about Bev, the character of Bev, Cassie's mother, and the two sort of interesting puzzles to me. One, that Bev is always described as sort of a fleshy woman, and Cassie's always described as this sort of wisp of a thing. I thought there was kind of an archetypal play there, and also that Bev's work, which he is described as really gifted in, is hospice, is the work of the dying. And actually, there's a little quip when they move towns. I think Bev says, you know, there's death everywhere. And yeah. And there's something interesting there. I thought, well, so, you know, is Cassie's model of womanhood and the woman, you know, this is a single child of a single mother. So the woman who has tremendous control over Cassie's life and experience, you know, is this woman who's also associated with death and with the flesh, and interesting thing, this sort of question of would Cassie grow into Bev, or was Bev the model that Cassie had? So it's something, there's just something I played with. I don't know what the answer is, but it seems like a related question to me.
I also thought about, you know, you're right that Cassie is very much contrasted with her mother's, you know, her mother's build, but she also is very much contrasted with Julia's build. You know, she's the tiny little bird-like albino girl. And then Julia is tall and sturdy and described as, you know, having breasts and hips before Cassie has developed then. And her hair is dark and curly. And I thought there was something interesting going on there too, in the way they are sort of presented as almost like, you know, the opposite image of each other, the negative of the other one. And, and you know, they talk about themselves as sisters, but it's almost like the inverse of what each one is in so many ways, everything from, you know, class to family life to the mothers that they have. And I wanted to go back to something that you said, Chris, when you talk about that quote on page 111 about, you know, what it is to be a girl. I was really compelled by that description in this novel. I thought it really captured so well, like, what it is to emerge from girlhood into young womanhood, and that sort of growing awareness of your own vulnerability, and how that can be really terrifying. And it is something that I think about as a lot as the mother of daughters of, right. You know, on the one hand, I want to protect them from that knowledge as long as possible because it makes them happier, their innocence, right? And yet I fear that it makes them more vulnerable too. And it does kind of feel like putting on that cloak, like a cloak as something that kind of can warm you, protect you, maybe make you fly, will both be a good thing for them, but also sort of poisoning, because once you've put it on, you can never take it off. Right. You know, I mean, as she describes it, like it burns into your flesh, you can't remove it. Like once you have the knowledge of the evil that's possible in the world, it's nothing you can ever vanquish from your mind.
Yeah, I was thinking about that a lot, because up until that moment in the book, I felt kind of, as I was saying before, I just related, you know, almost one for one with everything that they were talking about. And I was thinking about my own childhood and, oh, I used to do that. And I had a friend just like this. And, you know, it was very easy for me to kind of connect with exactly what they were thinking about during this kind of innocent period, or, you know, of their youth. And then with that one line, and I loved it, how abruptly it sort of comes in, it suddenly it was, you know, completely different, you know, experience going forward. And, you know, growing up as a boy, and, you know, you don't have, I think, that exact, you know, turning point. One thing that I kept thinking about was Rudy, the guy that she goes to interview for her speech class. I thought that was something that she did that I thought immediately, wow, I never would have done that at that age. I would have been terrified to go into some other person's house and ask him questions about the worst thing that ever happened to him. And her father goes with her to sort of, I guess, kind of back her up. But I kept thinking at the same time, I don't know that I would have had the nerve to do that. And then later in the novel, Rudy winds up being, she has that exact, we were talking earlier about the moment where she's imagining how scared Cassie would be to get in the car with a strange man. And then she does that with Rudy, and she's not scared. She feels that she can trust him. And I was thinking about that power dynamic again. I wondered how much of that power she feels she has over him is because now she, after doing the interview, she knows him, and she knows about, you know, sort of the painful parts of his life. He gave that to her, and so now she has that. And should that some sort of power comes with that. There is power in sort of knowing people's stories.
Yeah, although you know what I found kind of interesting there too was when she decides to call him, she's thinking about like who she needs, like who she who could be her ally. And she's thinking, and she's like, she says, I need an ally who believed the way I did in premonitions and auguries and instincts rather than logic, like a kid or a prophet or like a Hagrid. And at first that kind of stopped me because you know, sometimes I feel like books are reluctant to reference other books because it kind of locates them in a place and time where, you know, they fear that that reference will no longer be valid down the line. But then it kind of spoke to me about exactly this thing that we're talking about, which is the way that we are so shaped by the stories that we've read, and that mm-hmm. they become kind of part of our experience. And so I think in her head, she like makes him Hagrid. Like he is the kind of caretaker, right? And he has the big dog just like Hagrid's, and so she doesn't have this fear of getting into the car because he's not that creepy guy on the side of the road who might abduct her. He is this other character, and if that is his role, he cannot be scary. It's all about the roles in which we choose to place people, almost more than, you know. And of course that's ridiculous, right? Because like, of course he could, he's drunk when he picks her up, and like he's not he doesn't have any special magical powers, and and it's not at all clear that this is going to turn out well, but it affects her own perception of like what is possible and what is to be feared and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chris and Emily, it's been great talking with both of you. This has been a really enlightening conversation. Thank you so much for joining me too.
Such a pleasure.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you very much. It's been wonderful reading this.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM.
Thank you.
Next up, New Haven librarian Erica Carr recommends the book The Sun is Also a Star by Nicola Yoon.
Hi, I'm Erica Carr, the assistant teen librarian at the New Haven Free Public Library. I'm here to recommend and review the young adult book of the week, The Sun is Also a Star by Nicola Yoon. When reading this book, you're brought into the hearts and minds of two complete strangers as you follow them through New York City and all they encounter along the way. The story revolves around Natasha and Daniel, who happen to be polar opposites and come from two different cultural backgrounds. Daniel comes from a traditional Korean-American family where his parents expect the absolute best from him and his older brother, Charlie. The only problem is Charlie, the all-around perfect son, gets kicked out of Harvard, and now the pressure of going to Yale and being a doctor is all on Daniel, despite that he loves to write poetry and has no interest in fulfilling his parents' dream. Daniel runs the risk of either disappointing his family or giving up the life he truly wants. Natasha, on the other hand, immigrated from Jamaica with her family when she was younger to help pursue her father's dreams in acting. Now that years have passed, nothing has come from it. The strain between Natasha and her family has grown even thicker, especially now that they're being deported back to Jamaica. Even though Natasha isn't much of a dreamer, or even an optimist for that matter, she has to do everything she can to save her family from being deported in the matter of just one day. The story of The Sun is Also a Star is a whirlwind romance that tickles unlikely lovers and brings them together by coincidence, science, or just sheer fate. Even Daniel isn't exactly sure what brought him to Natasha that very day, but he knew from the very moment he laid eyes on her that she was the one. Natasha herself can't seem to understand why she finds Daniel on what seems to be the worst day of her life, but this time she spends with him gives her more than just hope. She finds love. Nicola Yoon will take you through a journey of joy and anguish of these two lovers and the lives of everyone else around them. With each page, you're left wondering if fate and the power of love is strong enough to fight all the opposition they manage to face in the course of just one day. For more teen books and programs, come visit the library's Teen Center at the Iris Main Library at 133 Elm Street. You can find more information on our website, www.nhfpl.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. As a reminder, all books discussed on the Book Talk can always be found on the New Haven Free Public Library.
Thanks, Erica. On our next show, airing September 20th, we'll be talking about the novel Hollow, first with the author, Owen Edgerton, and then with my guests, Annie Toms and Jessica Sager. You can see what else is coming up or listen to old episodes on our website, booktalkradio.net. And, as ever, you can share your thoughts about this episode or any other on Facebook or Twitter, or by emailing me directly at booktalkwnhh@gmail.com. Until next time, happy reading.